This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Our guest, Professor Bjorn Stevens, is director at the Max Planck Institute for Meteorology, where he leads the atmosphere in the Earth System Department. He's also a professor at the University of Hamburg. Dr. Stevens was previously at the University of California in Los Angeles. Although born in Germany, he's an American citizen. He was educated in the United States. Bjorn Stevens is one of the world authorities on clouds and climate change. He's the lead author of a new paper on the limits of aerosol impacts on global warming, and that paper has already stirred up controversy, including among climate skeptics. Bjorn Stevens, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
The public knows so little about this scientific discussion, except when it's called global dimming. Is that an appropriate label?
Well, I'm not even sure people know that much about global dimming. There is this concept of global dimming and global brightening, which is normally associated with this regional pattern over Europe that happened in the 1950s to 1980s, where it seemed to be surface measurements of radiation were somewhat dimmed and then got brighter after the 1980s. And that's usually attributed to the atmospheric aerosol and human emissions of aerosols and aerosols precursors. Even that's a bit controversial to what extent that's due to aerosol processes. So when you speak about global dimming, it often gets convolved with this regional dimming and brightening. So it's even a bit unclear to me how much people really understand the aerosol issue, even when it's called global dimming.
Well, maybe we should back up a bit. What is an aerosol? How would you describe them?
Well, there's the formal definition. Formally, an aerosol is just a dispersion of one phase of matter in another. So an example would be, for instance, gas bubbles, gas phase suspended in liquid. So that would be an example of aerosol. When a wave breaks and you have lots of gas bubbles floating around in the water, that's an aerosol. Or if you have liquid phase suspended in the air, which is what a cloud is, that's also an aerosol. Or ice particles, which is a solid phase, that's also an aerosol. But usually, as atmospheric scientists, when we think of aerosols, we normally think of the non-water particulate matter suspended in the atmosphere, the very small submicron particles that are everywhere in the air. The atmosphere is full of particulates, and many of these are actually quite natural, as anyone who has seen a dust storm or tasted the salt in a sea breeze or sneezed in a field of hay can attest.
So you've entered into quite a debate with your new paper. Please tell us the title of the paper and give us an introduction as to why you did this study.
Well, the paper is called Rethinking the Lower Bound on Aerosol Radiative Forcing, and it arose out of an argument I had with some authors of a very influential study from the early 1990s, which I believe greatly overstated the magnitude of the aerosol forcing. So I was trying to convince them in a series of emails what I thought was flawed in their original reasoning. And at some point I thought, well, maybe it's just better to write these ideas down in a paper and then they can be evaluated as part of the normal scientific process. And the argument has something to do what I believe there's a long tradition of overstating the magnitude of aerosol forcing. And it's a very easy trap to fall into, because if you look too narrowly at the subject, it's very easy to get lost in the details. And my paper was an attempt to step back a bit and explain why I think a large, at least in magnitude, aerosol radiative forcing really doesn't make physical sense.
And I'm told there are two approaches to calculating the cooling effect of human-made pollution. One is to try and add up all the known sources, from factories to burning fields in Africa. You took quite a different approach, didn't you?
Yes, I did. Rather than trying to estimate the aerosol forcing directly in what one might call a bottom-up approach, where you try to go to the smallest scale and add up all the little pieces and how they interact and estimate the uncertainty, I focused more on not the aerosol forcing itself, but on the bounds and the extent to which a given bound is consistent with our broader understanding of the climate system. And by a bound, I mean the question is, how big could the aerosol forcing be and still be consistent with other things we know about the climate system? A good example of a bound would be that if you had to make a physical measurement, say the diameter of a pipe, you might be uncertain in lots of things that you're doing, and you could estimate that uncertainty. And if you formally added up all that uncertainty, it's quite conceivable that you'd come up with an answer that says the pipe has a negative diameter, which of course makes no physical sense. So you know right away that the pipe has a diameter greater than zero. So that's an example of a bound. The diameter of the pipe has to be greater than zero. And for the aerosol forcing, I also focused on the bounds, and I said, well, how negative could an aerosol forcing be and still be consistent with the big picture? So this forced me to look at the big picture directly rather than trying to piece it together through the details.
An important part of your paper, it seems to me, depends on estimating the impacts of pollution in the first half of the 20th century. How could you possibly know about pollution in the 1930s or 1940s, for example?
Yeah, the paper actually outlines several different lines of argument for why I think the aerosol forcing is less negative than often assumed. And one of those is, as you said, it's about the importance of pollution in the first half of the 20th century. I assume that the global aerosol effect is proportional to that associated with anthropogenic SO2 or sulfur dioxide emissions. When we account for fossil fuel use, which is reasonably well known over the past 100 or 200 years, we can get a pretty good handle on SO2 emissions because we know the sulfur content of fuels. There's a long tradition, actually, of scaling aerosol forcing with anthropogenic SO2 emissions. In fact, that very early study that I was arguing with, which got me into this topic to begin with, did the same thing. So I go a bit further, actually, and I show in my study that this tradition of saying that the total aerosol forcing is proportional to that, to the SO2 emissions, is actually well supported by the much more complicated calculations which try to add up the different sources that happen regionally and over time.
I realize this is a huge question, but can you say that there are important differences between pollution in this new century compared with the aerosols created in the 1900s?
Well, an important difference is that it's not changing nearly as rapidly as it was 100 years ago. So at the beginning of the industrial era, we had a really explosion of human-related aerosol emissions. So if you look in the early part of the 20th century and you look at how SO2 increased sulfur dioxide emissions, it was enormous. When you look globally, there's actually very little evidence that there's been much change in the net anthropogenic emissions of aerosols over the last 40 years. People get very excited about regional changes. So you see, for instance, as China has developed over the past 10 or 15 years, you've seen an enormous increase, and people have all seen the pictures of smog over China. There's been an enormous increase in terms of aerosol emissions or aerosol precursor emissions over China. But at the same time, what you've seen is declining emissions of SO2 as Europe and North America have desulfurized their fuels. So you've seen big regional changes over the last 40 years. But globally, the big difference is that the aerosol forcing was changing a lot at the beginning of last century and really hasn't been changing very much over the past 40 years.
I'd like to turn to the difficult subject of equilibrium climate sensitivity, or ECS. Bjorn Stevens, how can a non-scientist understand what this means?
Oh, it's actually a very simple idea, and that's its appeal. Maybe one analogy is to think of a pot of water on a camp stove. And imagine the water is not too hot, so it's not boiling, the flame's not too high. And, you know, if you have the flame really on a low temperature, then you'd be heating up the water, and it's kind of losing its heat to the air, so it's giving off steam. And it would kind of be at a constant temperature. If the flame's not too high, you might even be able to put your finger in the water without boiling it. Now, if you turn up the flame a little bit more, the water will get a bit hotter, and it'll keep going until it starts boiling. But in many ways, this question of, for a given increase in the flame, how hot does the water get, is very much the same idea of equilibrium climate sensitivity. For the pot of water, it might be better to think of, you know, what's the temperature of the water if you put the lid half on or three-quarters on or fully on, because, you know, if you put a little bit of heat in the bottom of the pot and you have the lid fully on, the water will be hotter than if you had the lid fully off. That would be a bit like the case of greenhouse gases. So climate sensitivity is really just the simple attempt to ask, if you increase the forcing, the heating of the planet, or decrease its ability to cool, how much warmer will it get? And formally, it comes to this question. We like to phrase it as equilibrium climate sensitivity. We like to think of a particular scenario that's especially easy. We say, just imagine you double the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere. How much warmer on average would the near surface air temperatures be? And that number is the equilibrium climate sensitivity.
Do we have an answer to that, a firm answer?
Well, we don't have the answer in the form of one number, like 4 or 4.2, but we have a range of values which have stood the test of time for what that number, what we think that number is. And it's a range that goes between 1.5 and 4.5 degrees Celsius. And a lot of the game over the last years has been to see if we can actually narrow the range in that estimate, because it's pretty broad.
So good. How does your work on the limits of aerosol forcing impact our understanding of climate sensitivity?
Well, it's a bit of a distance from my work to climate sensitivity, and they really come together, because if one attempts to estimate the climate sensitivity by the historical record of temperature changes and the historical record of radiative forcing, then the aerosol forcing is an important part of that calculation. And if you estimate things in that way, what my research would suggest is that the climate is a little bit less sensitive than it would have been if the aerosol forcing had been much larger in magnitude.
Why do you think climate skeptics and skeptical scientists like Nick Lewis and Judith Curry are among the first to write extensively about your new paper?
Well, I don't know. I find it a bit dangerous to speculate about people's motivations, and to be honest, I really don't pay much attention to the blogosphere. If anything, I make a conscious attempt to ignore it. I certainly can understand why someone who is of the opinion that the public was overly alarmed by the risk of warmings might want to draw attention to my paper, because it's going to help you make one or the other argument. And likewise, if someone was of the opinion that the public is not sufficiently alarmed about the risks of warming, they might find undue attention on my paper as a bit counterproductive. But I don't know. As a scientist, I think we have an obligation to clearly state what we believe to be true, irrespective of how we perceive that might be used by others.
Does your view of a lower impact from aerosol pollution change the models and conclusions in the reports by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change?
Well, my work suggests that models are overstating the impact of the anthropogenic aerosol. And maybe that's not so surprising. Modeling the atmospheric aerosol is really fantastically difficult. It's loosely based on basic principles and not very well constrained by data. So I don't think anyone finds it surprising that attempts to model such a detailed life cycle of something as complex and as poorly understood as the aerosol could be off, and off by a large factor. I was part of the IPCC assessment, of the last assessment, the fifth assessment, and I think based on the information available at that time, the assessment was a reasonable one. My study brings new arguments to the table, and I would expect or hope that these will be reflected in the next assessment.
And you did give a talk at Ringberg last spring, which began with the title, Some Not Yet Entirely Convincing Reasons Why This Is So. Does this suggest you think the question is still open for debate?
Let's see if I answer that properly. I think ECS, or equilibrium climate sensitivity, of less than 2 degrees is pretty hard to reconcile with what we know about the paleo record, or the behavior of the Earth through the course of ice ages, or even over longer time periods. And an equilibrium climate sensitivity over 3.5 is pretty hard to reconcile with the instrumental record. There's additional evidence that points to why an ECS, say less than 2 or greater than 3.5 or 4, should be seen as unlikely. But this is an ongoing argument. It's ongoing research, some of which is at the heart of the things we're doing here at my laboratory in Hamburg.
Some critics say you've dismissed the important role played by black carbon. What do you say about that?
Well, the issue certainly came up in the reviews of my paper. And black carbon, like many aspects of the aerosol, is often used as a joker, which allows people to play it any way that one finds convenient. So, for instance, colleagues have argued that I neglected the large increase in black carbon in the middle of the last century. So one of the arguments I actually gave was that the temperature increase in the middle of last century is hard to explain if you assume a large aerosol cooling. And they say, you forgot black carbon in the middle part of the last century. And then other colleagues come and they say, well, actually, the black carbon was all happening in the latter part of the century. There's many people who argue that black carbon is playing a disproportionate role in the forcing in the present period. So there's been people arguing that black carbon is contributing substantial warming to the climate in the present. Yet some of the same scientists then actually say that the lack of a surface warming signal in the past 15 years, or the modesty of the surface warming signal in the past 15 years, is because of the aerosol, and the implication being black carbon is not playing a role. So throughout all of this, I think it's important to realize that the aerosol is a very complex component of the climate system. And it's easy to think of reasons why, you know, it might be behaving in a particularly unusual way, which can explain this or that fact about the climate system. I tended to take a more conservative approach. And I think when you look at it from an aerosol point of view, the reality is that the aerosol forcing is, if it's important, it was far more important in the last century when CO2 wasn't playing such an important role. And I think as aerosol science matures, it will be increasingly apparent to people that to the extent we want to speculate about the role of the aerosol in future climate, the role of black carbon now, the role of it in the past, really depends on our ability to robustly demonstrate what was it about the 20th century that was different because we had such a large aerosol forcing. No one would dispute in the 20th century aerosol was a major player in the forcing of the climate system. In the 21st century, it won't be. CO2 keeps chugging away, more and more CO2. Aerosol hasn't really changed in 40 years. And so if you're looking for an aerosol signal, say from black carbon or from sulfate or from other components of aerosol, the real place to look is in the 20th century, not in the 21st century.
And it seems your work began with a global picture, as you say, and global data. Is that not a limitation when it comes to determining the regional impacts of aerosol pollution in places like China or North India?
It depends a bit what you mean by regional impacts. Certainly, it's a limitation if you're interested in regional health impacts. But if you're interested in the effect on global warming, the global signal, then the scientific question is the effect of the aerosol linear in the emissions? And if it's linear in the emissions, the global effect, then it's not a limitation of neglecting these sort of regional hotspots. And aerosol interactions with radiation are largely linear. That's the basis of most theoretical treatments of it. When you think about aerosol cloud interactions, those are nonlinear, and I accounted for these nonlinearities. Whether I do so adequately is something that we're presently testing in my laboratory. One aspect that I'm quite fond of in my study is that the assumptions I make are all very transparent and very testable, and I think that's really the key to advancing the science. In the end, it's less important to be right or wrong or to get the right number than it is to advance constructive scientific arguments and really have ideas that other people can check and follow up on. And when it comes to the pattern of aerosol forcing, I think my study was quite clear in how one can do that.
This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest from Hamburg, Germany, is atmospheric scientist Bjorn Stevens. We're discussing his new paper, Rethinking the Lower Bound on Aerosol Radiative Forcing, and what that means for us all. Now, the IPCC has acknowledged trying to calculate cloud activity is one of the most difficult problems of all. How does aerosol pollution interact with clouds? You'd mentioned that before. How does that affect the cooling or lack of cooling?
Well, the main effect is probably to make the clouds a bit brighter because the cloud droplets form on more particles, on an average are a bit smaller. It gives them a bit more surface area and they scatter more radiation. The next order effect we generally think is it makes the clouds mix a bit more efficiently so that they contain a bit less condensate. That tends to offset the other effect. And it's a bit of a lesson there as research over the past 30 years is really, I think, one of the things that's clearly come out of the research is that aerosol interactions with clouds happen in many, many different ways. But they happen in opposing ways. Many of them act to offset or buffer one another. Fundamentally, it's really important to remember that clouds form in response to atmospheric circulations, and the circulations are driven by the interaction of radiation with things like water vapor. And the role of the aerosol in explaining cloud formation is interesting, often fascinating, but really secondary.
Do you think there will ever be a cloud theory which could predict their behavior, a kind of solid theory of clouds?
Oh, I would say we already have some very compelling theories that have helped us understand a great deal about clouds. For the most part, we know the basic equations for clouds. When we do have uncertainties on the basic level, they come from a poor understanding of ice processes and difficulty in developing an aggregated view of clouds. So we have the basic equations to describe clouds, modulo some understanding of ice processes. We have a real difficult time when it talks about the aggregated behavior of the clouds, if you like, the sociology of clouds. But here I see a lot of prospects for a bright future for cloud and water vapor research, both because of the capacity we have for field measurements, advances in satellite remote sensing of clouds, especially three-dimensionally, There's a range of satellite sensors that can probe through the depth of the atmosphere and tell you a lot about the morphology of clouds and their placement through the vertical depth of the atmosphere. And advances in computing allow us to use the basic equations, which we know reasonably well and understand, to explore what I was calling this sociology of clouds, the aggregated behavior of fields of clouds. So I'm quite optimistic that we can begin bringing together a lot of fairly well-developed theoretical ideas we have of clouds into a more consistent global picture.
From my perspective, Bjorn, if your research results become widely accepted and proven true, this could be good news. I say that because many of us, including scientists like James Lovelock and James Hansen, feared that cleaning up air pollution could unleash warming rather quickly, almost like a climate punch. But maybe we have less to worry about if we clean up.
Yeah, indeed. I've been saying for a while we have nothing to fear from clean air.
Right, and we could possibly save millions of lives if we can do it. So is there a test that would vindicate your assessment that aerosol forcing may be much lower than we thought, or do you think it's already proven?
Well, mathematicians and lawyers are probably the only class of individuals that prove things. Scientists develop narratives, and we argue about them. And at some point, the arguments become so convincing that in the absence of new information, we spend our time arguing about other things. So, for instance, we don't spend much time arguing about evolution anymore, or we don't really worry about whether or not the sun's at the center of the solar system. And I think most scientists really don't argue very much about whether increasing level of CO2 are due to humans and whether or not that causes warming. And so at most I can hope we'll spend a little less time arguing about the importance of the atmospheric aerosol. But that may take some time.
You know, I'm struggling to picture how we could move this important discussion out of the scientific conference halls and journals and into the public mind. Do you have ideas how we could frame this debate so that anyone with a high school education could understand it, or is it too soon for that?
I'm not sure. I think regardless of how one looks at the debate, it's very important to understand that the question of aerosol forcing is really a question of, as I said before, it's a question of the 20th century, not the 21st century. When thinking about research priorities for the 21st century, what's changing and what's happening is that the Earth is warming and CO2 concentrations are increasing. And we don't really understand what that means in some detail. We know that the Earth's going to get warmer, but with a warmer world, do the rain bands shift? Do the storms intensify? These are the sorts of questions which I think we increasingly need to focus on. And we need to think about how we can measure the changes that are happening to the Earth system as we go through this unprecedented change in the composition of the atmosphere, as we increase the amount of CO2, as the Earth warms. Are we measuring the flows of energy through the system adequately? And the answer is no. Are we keeping track of the ocean's heat content adequately? And the answer is probably no. And are we keeping our eye on the prize in terms of what is the distribution of clouds and water vapor in the atmosphere? And the structure of circulation systems, which we're arguing may be changing. And there's a real danger that rather than looking at these basic fundamental aspects of the Earth system as it warms, we'll turn ourselves to an ever more detailed view, what I would call an embroidery of the climate system, because those are new and interesting and fascinating things, but they're probably not the most important things.
So you would say that aerosols are perhaps not what leaders at the Paris Climate Talk should be talking about?
Well, certainly cleaning up the aerosol is hugely important for human health, and they shouldn't worry about cleaning up the air. So I would hope that would be the simplest of things that they could do, because I really see very little repercussion from cleaning up the air in terms of the global climate system. And huge benefits, as far as I understand it, are likely to follow for human health. So maybe that's one thing they should be talking about in that sense. They should, of course, be talking about CO2, because every molecule of CO2 we don't emit today does, I like to say, 1,000 years of good. Another thing that they should be talking about is that as we try to adapt, which we'll have to do in part, regardless of how much we mitigate against CO2 emissions, how we adapt is far more a question of basic research than most policymakers, and I would venture even scientists, appreciate. Forsaking the basic science or trying to tie it too closely to the perceived needs of the policy communities is, I would say, grossly negligent of future generations, because the climate's changing. And one thing we know is we're going to have surprises. And the best way to prepare society for surprises is to give scientists the creative potential to think about the things that they wouldn't ordinarily think about if they were following the short-term needs of the policy community. And that's what you call curiosity-driven or basic research. And I think we're not leaving enough space for that in climate science.
As we finish up, Bjorn, is there anything else you would like to leave with our listeners?
Well, I would like to say science is fun. It's great fun. There's huge challenges facing climate sciences. And most of these are related to understanding how the atmospheric circulation will respond to warming. I think we should stop, well, most of us actually have stopped posing the question as to whether the Earth will warm because of increasing CO2. The real question is what happens when it warms. So we've spent most of the last 40 years asking whether the Earth will warm and to what extent humans are responsible. We know the answers. The answer is yes and yes. So the real interesting and fun questions scientifically are how Earth's circulation systems respond to this warming. And the more we look at it, the more we appreciate that clouds are at the heart of this puzzle. So it's a great time to be interested in clouds and circulation and atmospheric science.
We've been talking with the director of the prestigious Max Planck Institute for Meteorology in Hamburg, Germany, Bjorn Stevens. Dr. Stevens, it's been an honor to have you on Radio EcoShock. Thank you so much.
Yeah, it was my pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.